The guy on the bridge about to jump off said, "I'm a Baptist." "What type of Baptist? Northern Baptist, Southern Baptist?" He says, "I'm a Southern Baptist." "Same as me," said the guy who had stopped. "I'm a Southern Baptist too." And he said, "What type of Southern Baptist? 1912 Reformed or 1912 Unreformed?" He said, "I'm 1912 Unreformed." And the guy who stopped his car said, "I'm 1912 Reformed." And he pushed him off the bridge. Thank you for laughing. And you see, people be so much friends. "You're a Buddhist? I'm a Buddhist. You're Theravada? I'm Theravada. You're Forest Edition?" "No, I'm not Forest Edition." And get pushed off a bridge. And again, thank you for laughing again. There was one gentleman, he was supposed to give a talk during the range retreat when the monks are off in the range retreat, the nuns are in the range retreat, so we don't come out here. And he was a bit concerned about his talk, and he asked me for some advice, how can I give a talk? And I said, "Well, tell a couple of jokes every now and again so that everybody can get a bit entertained and they're enjoying what you're saying." And I said, "Make sure that Van comes along, that you come along as well, because when she laughs, she's got such a good laugh there." And I said, "You can actually pay her $5 to go to make sure she comes." "Oh, yeah, good idea." "No, I don't pay you, do I?" "No, no, you come. But it's nice to..." You know, the laughter actually just gets inside of a person and it makes you happy. It's much better than sort of getting critical of the people. But anyway, so that's one of the reasons why I always try and be kind to people. Instead of arguing, say what you're saying is wrong, just saying that we have different ideas and different ways of looking at things. But one of the things which one of the gentlemen said, he said, "Oh, you know, some of you Buddhists always say that meditation is a be-all and end-all of Buddhism." And I said, "Yeah, that's pretty accurate." And he was trying to say it as a criticism. But you know that the meditation depends, you know, what you understand as meditation. And when a meditation, you understand it as what I was saying earlier, learning how to really relax to the max. How many people are relaxed in our world today? Maybe years before, people were much more relaxed, and I think that's probably true. You know, I've got all these wonderful memories of when I first went to Thailand in 1974. Yeah. And when you went over there, especially outside of Bangkok, up in the northeast, into the very remote areas, and in those remote areas, there was no electricity, there was no tarred roads, there was actually no medicine to speak of. And because it was so simple, it shocked me. I know that every now and again you had people from Peace Corps and people from, some of the VSO, that's like the English, the British organization, VSO, young people just going to try and help just the poor people of that part of the world. And after a while, I would meet with many of them and discuss what they were doing. And they all agreed. They were out there to try and help the locals in the northeast Thailand. But actually, they learned much more than they ever helped others. And I knew the Thai and the Isan people there. And they always used to say that, yes, you know, they come here to help us, but we end up spending more time with them. And they always end up by saying thank you for all that we've learned from you. Some of the different attitudes which people had. And the attitudes are always kind. And the kindness was the most important. It's more important than any wealth. And the kindness was probably what kept them, you know, really healthy and happy together. And some of those memories I have in those days were, just you go into the village, sometimes a ceremony at night time. And when you went into those villages, you'd actually see every evening in the upstairs, you know, just wooden rough floor, in the upstairs there, that the whole family were out. I think I said this last week, didn't I? Or I must have said this over in another venue. And the whole family were out then. There's about 16 or 17 of them. You know, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. But they're the grandparents, the uncles, the aunties, the parents, and the children, and the cousins, and the, they all lived in the same house. And it was not very big, but because they lived in the same house, they just all loved each other to bits. And they'd tell the stories every evening. And most of those stories were exaggerations, but the kids would always ask for them, can you please tell that story again? And they were funny stories, and those funny stories were what actually they shared every evening in the village. And I remember the light, there's no electricity in the village. The light, they had a little bowl where they had some kerosene in, and they had a rag which was poked through the top of a toothpaste tube, which made a wonderful wick. And they would light that, and that you could just see each other's faces. They're squealing, laughing, and the kids anyway. And the smoke from that light would keep all the mosquitoes away. I remember years later going there, and people would often say about in those old days, they didn't have much, but they had each other. They had a lot of love in that family, and a lot of security in the fact they knew each other and they'd always have a place they could go to. They'd always find food somewhere. And so these days they said, I remember one of the villagers trying to put it into words, he said, in the old days, you know, we had little buckets and we had enough water, but today we have much bigger buckets, but the bucket has got so many leaks in it. So many ways of, you know, our time and our money just leaking through the bucket because, you know, the times have changed. We have so many other things to do. We don't have as much time. And when they said that, I thought, well, that's, I can understand that. That sometimes when we try and get more prosperous, we sometimes think that that's the way for security, that's the way for prosperity, that's progress. Sometimes I prefer simplicity. So when they said that meditation is the be-all and end-all of Buddhism, yes. When you call it like stillness, not sort of concentration. Many of you have gone to my meditation retreats or meditation classes. When people call it concentration, I thought, oh my goodness, that's terrible. Because that turns Jhana Grove, our retreat center, into a concentration camp. Something you have to do and something you're judged on. Now stillness, how can you judge stillness? If you try and judge stillness, you're disturbing it. So instead of judging it, we just experience it. It's beautiful. And how do you become still? By relaxing. And it has so many benefits in the world when you can take time out to be still, to relax and rest. So much so that if it's done properly, you take some still time for yourself, sort of every day, especially when you're at work. People always seem to get stressed out. And even today, there's not enough people working here, not enough people working there. So if you have got a job, you have to work really hard. Do you? Or is there another way to get lots done without any stress? And of course there is. You've heard me say this before. This was based on one of Ajahn Chah's similes, which was based on Ajahn Chah's simile. But it really works. It's, you know, just the, oh, I lost it. How heavy is the cup simile? And I remember, I remember just one function which I went to. I think it was one of the Thai functions over in Perth. And there was the local MP for Perth, this is the State Parliament. She had to give a talk, a presentation, I think it was a big Thai day. And she went up the stage and she held up a glass and said, one wise person once said that how heavy is the glass? And I was laughing my head off when she was saying this because I made that, this story up. How heavy is the glass? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. You hold it for 2 or 3 minutes, you'll be in pain. 4 minutes, you'll be in agony. 5 minutes, you'll be in a hospital case. and really stupid. What do you do when it starts getting too heavy to hold comfortably? You put it down. Are you being irresponsible to put this thing down? You got work to do. Carry on. No, you're being highly responsible, because once you put it down, you lift it up again after a couple of, well, it's about 30 seconds, it feels lighter. Try it yourself. Now that's what stress is all about. You don't know how to put things down, to relax to the max, to be still. Because when you are still, your energies come back, especially in your brain and in your mind. And healing happens. Every now and again you see that people who have been abused or wounded or in a serious medical condition, they're putting in forced coma for just an hour, 2 hours, or 6 months, or not 6 months, sorry, or 6 hours or something. Because when they're not interrupting the process, the healing can happen much faster. Have you ever noticed that? What do you do when you get a cut on your, say, your arm? Put a plaster on it. What actually are you really doing? You're isolating it, keeping you away from it, so it can relax and heal. It heals much better without you. However, what some people do, they put a plaster on their arm. Okay, I've done the right thing, I put a plaster on the arm. And then they have a look at it. Is it okay now? No. They keep interfering with it. They don't let things happen. They don't let things be. We're always, why do people do that? It's because, again, they fear. They don't trust when they don't do things. They have to think about it. They have to do something. They have to get involved instead of just letting things happen. You know, for quite a while now, when people actually drive me here, drive me there, sometimes in their cars they have these like Google Maps things. And they're much better than me telling people where to go. If it was me telling people where to go, I'd just say, put the brake on, let go, relax. We'll never get anywhere. But it's a wonderful thing. We can trust it. Because we can trust it, we don't have to worry about where we need to go. But then when people don't have those instructions on the Google Maps or whatever, then they turn the radio on. Every now and again, when you're going down the road, you're just going to hear boom, 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 boom. I know the windows are closed in people's cars. They must be getting deaf very prematurely. But why do we need music? Why? And a lot of times it is not because you're interested in that particular song. You just need something to distract yourself. You don't know how to relax. Remember one of our members years ago, she was a teacher. She was working in Broome. And she said the indigenous people would always tell her, "Ma'am, you're walking too fast." I thought it was a wonderful comment here. Do you walk too fast? A lot of times we do. Do you think too fast? Certainly. See if you can think slowly. Sometimes I wondered whether we can develop speed cameras, not for your car, but for your brain, and fine you for thinking too fast. What a wonderful thing that would do. You know, sometimes you think, I even like speaking. Do you speak too much? How many people speak too much? But that's my job. I've got a good excuse. But I remember once thinking about in the Western countries, we always celebrate free speech. And it causes us a lot of problems. I think speech should never be free. We should tax it. Imagine taxing speech. Who would be paying the most in taxes? The politicians. They really know how to speak a lot. And so when we tax the politicians, so no free speech anymore, speech is always taxable. I remember that idea because I saw something in the news, but they're going to tax cows for burping too much. That's true, I'm not making that up. That was either in New Zealand. Cows and sheep are going to be taxed, or rather the farmers who own them, because they burp too much. and that's bad for the environment. And I'm going to get taxed as well because I eat too many baked beans. So the BSWA is going to be paying for that. But anyway, the whole idea of like thinking so much, where does that actually get you? Imagine being still, being peaceful. Number one, you know how to relax. And you get more things done in your life. Those people over in Thailand didn't think that much and didn't have much, but they had happiness and they have the love, the joy between themselves. They knew how to relax a lot. And that's one thing we've basically forgotten. We're all tired because we work too much. We injure ourselves because we're not aware enough and we're too tired. Remember those stories of little babies, young people who fall out of balconies 3 or 4 stories up, and they have no bruises on them afterwards because they're relaxed. If I fell even a little bit, I'm going to fall, I'm going to get hurt. And you will get you will get hurt because you tense up, you don't know how to relax. So little by, I mustn't say little by little again, I said it again. So as we meditate or understand it's about stillness, relaxation, how does stillness and relaxation work? Only through kindness. You're kind to your body. You know the word of kindness, again, it's hard for people to understand what it means. So many of these words we think we know, but can you really be kind? Can you be kind to yourself? Obvious thing, it'd be wonderful to be kind to yourself. How to be kind to yourself? And again, I've taught that at the beginning of the meditation, you sweep your attention through your body and you're kind to all parts of it. It's amazing what you can do to your body. One of the monks, many years ago, he had a very bad back. Because he had a bad back, he went to the doctors and they gave him a CT scan and they found out he had a congenital deformity of his spine. There's nothing they could do. They said it's best not to meditate because, it'd be painful all the time. But I'm a monk. I need to meditate. Well, suit yourself. The doctor wasn't any help at all. But then he got this book about healing your own back, and it was a brilliant book. And I think it was written by a New Zealand gentleman, but I cannot remember the name. And all it was, he said, on either side of your spine, there are muscles which you just aren't aware of. So to create that awareness of the muscles on either side of the spine, every morning or afternoon, take your hand and rub those muscles with your hand, because you're creating a neural connection between those muscles and your brain. He did that for about 3 months, every morning, stroking those muscles until he could feel those muscles without having to touch them. Just like I can feel my fingers, but I can't feel, what else can I feel? I'm pretty aware of my body. I can't feel my kidneys right now because I can't even touch them and they're just pretty healthy. But I think they're there. But anyway, he could feel those muscles on either side of his spine, and then they said, then exercise them, stretch them, relax them, stretch them, relax them. How do you do that? And they said, just trial and error, try this and try that, try this, try that. And after a while, he could actually move those muscles. And he would exercise them every morning. And as you exercise both sides of these muscles, which most people don't know even exist, they have no connection with them, then they became so strong that they compensated for the weakness in his bones of his spine. No more pain, he could meditate. And that's a brilliant solution to a problem without needing surgery or medication. Just learning how to use your awareness and in order to create a sensitivity and then an exercise to strengthen some muscles which most people don't need to strengthen. And that reminded me of even when I was a kid watching the TV in England, seeing all these guys, lots of muscles on them, and they were moving the muscles in their chest. It was actually quite sick looking, but you know, we all had a look because it was weird. They could move muscles which, you know, I never knew you could even move. But nevertheless, that's what the awareness can do. It's amazing as a power. You can learn how to do things which you thought were impossible. And that, of course, is part of the meditation practice. And that meditation practice, even just simple things like how to be kind to your body and how to be kind to others. Simple things. I know that sometimes there was in the Mahayana tradition, they say everything is interconnected. Well, I hope not. Do you mean I'm interconnected with Donald Trump and with Mr. Putin and Mr. And of course, there's nothing to say that at all in Theravada Buddhism. They say you can be connected. We influence one another, but we can also disconnect. I remember in Berkeley once giving a talk, and again, it was with a Tibetan monk and a Zen monk, and they were saying everything is interconnected. And, you know, we were so nice to each other when we were giving a talk. We were getting nowhere. It was really boring. So after a while, I said, let's stir things up a bit. I said, I don't believe in all this interconnected stuff. And that really stirred things up. I said, yes, you do. I said, no, I don't. And then I was going, you know, what is this? Are you really caught up and connected with everything in this world? You can be if you want to. You can be, drop out of the world if you wish to. That's what we do when we're still. We're so peaceful. We can get another perception of this world, a perception of stillness and beauty. I was saying about this, I think last week, about, or a couple of weeks ago, about how our perceptions can be changed. Most of my perceptions, if you out there in the world, become influenced by other people's perceptions. And it's just almost like suggesting this interconnectedness. But when you're in your, say, in my cave and you meditate, you disconnect. And that's beautiful to be able to do that. Because a lot of times, and a lot of people tell me they're in healing professions, and sometimes it burns you out. It's not your problem. You listen to other people's problems, and you have so much empathy, and after a while, you know, you're just trying to find solutions, and you become one of the problems as well. That's one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah used to say, somebody asked me, you've got a good story of Ajahn Chah, this is one of those good stories. He actually said that if, when eventually he knew that I'd be a monk for a long time, later on in your life you'd have many people coming to you with all of their problems and asking for solutions. And you may have a good solution one day, maybe next day you haven't got a solution, but you know, you have a lot of people asking for help from you. So he said when people do ask for help, you have to imagine that you are a rubbish bin, a dustbin, a trash can. And you have to accept everybody's trash. That's my job as a monk. So a lot of time you come to the temple and you tell me all your trash, all the problems you have, sicknesses, unfair stuff happens, all the difficulties in this world, the COVID, you can't go and see your parents when they're really sick, all this sorts of stuff. And you've got to be kind, compassion. How can you do that? You know, wherever I go sometimes even on the aircraft, sometimes you go there, you've had a busy day, and you know, you've been giving talks or retreats somewhere else, and then you get tired. I remember this one time, I was in Malaysia, and this people from Malacca, they drove me from Malacca to the airport, and I was really tired. They were asking questions all the time. I didn't mind actually talking to them. Actually, they're, one's a nun, one's a monk at my monastery now, so it was a good investment. But really, you know who those are. You saw them today. Oh, I saw her. But anyway, nevertheless, it tires you out. You know, you're a human being. Listen to people's problems. You get tired. And then got on the aircraft, and then had a window seat. Window seats are the best because at least you can't talk to one person on one side of you. But then this lady came on, said, "You're Ajahn Brahm. There's nowhere to hide." So I said, "Oh, yes, I am. Oh, I really need to talk to you." This was on the aircraft on the way from Kuala Lumpur back to Perth. But I was fortunate there was somebody sitting in the seat next to me. I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, there's a person sitting in the seat next to me." And then she said to this person, "Oh, would you mind changing seats?" And I said, no, please don't. She said, "Okay." So there I was on the window seat. She was in the aisle seat. She had me captured, cornered. Oh, and she really talked all the time. And so I was really tired by the time I got to Perth. It's a long flight. But nevertheless, I always remembered Ajahn Chah's teaching. So when that happens, always remember you're a rubbish bin. Please accept people's whatever they need to tell you. But be the most important part of that, be the trash can, the rubbish bin, with a hole in the bottom. So you accept everything, but you keep nothing. That's a very difficult training, but it's the only way to be a good friend to others. And anyone in the counseling position as a nurse or a doctor or a psychologist, please make sure you've got a hole in the bottom. So what goes in can go right through you and out. And you're empty to receive the next person's problems. But you keep nothing yourself. They're not your problems. Your problem is you don't know how to put it down and let it go. That's why the meditation of learning how to be still and learning not to cling to things. It's important in all areas of your life, especially if you're in any counseling position in life. And of course, we're all in counseling positions. We all got our friends, relations, kids and others we want to look after and care for. So make sure that hole is very big. Otherwise, you'll keep collecting more and more and more of stuff which you never did. You don't know how to be still. We think too much. So all these little stories, they really help enormously if you're in a position like me or like you. As a person who cares for others, who wants to help, but sometimes gets so full you can't help. Or sometimes you get so angry, you get so tired. That's when you don't know how to put things down, you get so exhausted that the brain doesn't work anymore. I was a school teacher for 1 year after I graduated, but the only reason I was being a school teacher was one of the reasons why I became bald. All those kids made you tear your hair out. It was very stressful the first year of teaching, very kind kids. You know, interestingly, the most naughtiest kid in my class was the only one who sent me a letter when I'd become a monk. He kept in contact. And it was really fascinating. He was a very naughty kid because he liked me. He just needed attention, that's all. But anyway, you realize that you're trying to be kind, but sometimes people get frustrated and they get tired and they can't be innovative. That's one of the other things which I always remember when you know about stillness and meditation. The innovation just keeps coming up, different ways of doing things. Interesting ways of doing things. Ways of doing things which maybe other people can't see, but which actually really help. And those innovative ways of doing things sometimes can actually change a lot of, I was just talking about this earlier with someone. And it's my birthday in 2 months' time. It's a long time, isn't it? 2 months. The 7th of August, but people was asking me even this evening, "Are you planning to do anything to celebrate your birthday?" I said, "No." Other people are planning things, not me. But then this lady over in Singapore came up with this really interesting idea. She said, "Well, look, you know, in Singapore we've got a bit of funds over there. We can't actually send it to you because that'd be illegal. And because of the laws over there." But he said, "What we can do they were going to, like, I hope it works, because I think it's a really interesting idea. We asked our committee and stuff, they said, no, we can't do that. But then they came across with this wonderful solution, that they were going to hire the hotel for lunch. They're going to pay for everything, the hiring of the hotel, the food, everything. And people can, in Perth, can come in there, they come in there for free, basically. But then you give a donation. Isn't that money laundering? No, it's not money laundering. It's a beautiful way of they're helping. And then people who come here, because that's for the Meditation Retreat Centre over in Melbourne, which I'm sponsoring. I never use it for myself or this place when I have a birthday. It's always for some of the other projects which help so many other people, which is important, I think. So anyway, that's what they were thinking of doing. I hope it works, because I thought it was an innovative way of doing things. And those members of the committee especially, that if you can't come, then it costs more. They did this at a school some years ago, that it was one of the kids' concerts. And I don't know if you've been to any of those kids' concerts. No one really wants to go, but the parents sort of have to go. So the the head of the fundraising committee said, yes, okay, it's $20 to go and $30 to get permission from the principal not to go. And that year they cleaned up. It was just child psychology. It's all for a good cause. But no, sometimes just the kindness. It reminded me of this other story of kindness, especially with animals. Because this fellow told me a story. He said he went to the school of fate once. They're raising money for something or other. And there were camel rides around the park, the oval. And so he said it was an absolutely true story. He got there, and it was one of the hot days in summer here, and the camel was really tired. And so the fellow was actually, out of compassion for the camel, was actually saying no more rides. And this gentleman said, oh, look, I've always wanted to ride on a camel, and I don't mind paying double the fee or whatever, for it's a good cause, I can afford it. Can I please have, you know, a ride around the park? And the man, apparently the owner of the camel, looked at the camel and actually started talking nicely to him. He said, look, this gentleman has come a long way. He really wants to ride, you know, just one lap around the park. You know, and he's willing to give extra donation for the kids so we could have a wonderful new facility for them. Would you mind? He talked so kindly to the camel. He said the camel immediately squatted down so he could get on the camel's back to give it another ride around the park. Even the camel had that kindness to actually to sacrifice a little bit more just to raise some funds for the school. I know that the animals are always kind if you ask them nicely. I know that because you're so still. That relaxation to the max, that's where the kindness comes from. You know how to be kind to yourself, and you know how to give that kindness to others. I've had so many stories of animals just, oh, what's that story I think I told last week over in Melbourne when I went there? One of the monks was feeding a fox. Beautiful fox. I looked at it in its face and it was just, it's a gorgeous animal. And people said, oh, you shouldn't do that. But it was an act of kindness. And this little fox was coming every evening. It was cold. It would come there and would rest on the mat in the entrance to the monk's quarters there. It would rest on the mat there and this monk would come out and give it something to eat. And the little fox would actually take it out of the monk's hand. Very gently. It's a beautiful gesture, and I thought that was wonderful. It's like people say the monks of Bodhinyana shouldn't feed the kangaroos. I've said that to the monks, you shouldn't feed the kangaroos. But do you obey me? No. Of course not, because I feed the kangaroos myself. You can't resist it. You look at them, they're just sweet little animals. and they get to know you, and they're friendly. You know what the kangaroos like the most? Because I remember just having, when I'm being on retreat, I had my lunch, and after finishing the lunch, there was lots left over, so I just had some nice healthy food, an apple, some vegetables, a carrot. I thought they liked apples, but on the bottom, underneath it all, with their nose, they push the apple aside, they push the carrot aside, they push the lettuce aside, because right on the bottom was what they really wanted, pizza. They were Aussie kangaroos. And I remember, just imagine this was the pizza, the kangaroos with their paws, they learned how to eat it, with their paws. They're so cute to watch. And they didn't lose their teeth. They had lots of other stuff they eat as well. That was like a treat, a special. But it was, they say they shouldn't eat pizza. You ask the kangaroos, see what they say. But this is actually that kindness. That gave me a lot of joy, a lot of happiness. And seeing the other monks being kind to the animals with whom they lived. And all those animals, the cockatoos, and all these other ones who feel, they feel safe in our monasteries. And because they feel safe, they never harm us. And because they don't harm us, they feel safe. They're teaching us some important teachings of Buddhism. Being kind. People have different understandings of Buddhism, different types of Buddhism. Again, people ask me, just what type of Buddhism are you? Are you really Theravada? Because you act, you know. I said, there's one of these nuns many years ago. She was a wonderful nun. And she was a Mahayana nun from Taiwan. And you know, she said, you know, I said, are you a Bodhisattva? And he said, I'm supposed to be, you know, the selfish ones, you know, the ones on the path to arahatship and stuff like that. And I said, but look at you. You spend so much time by yourself, and I spend so much time working for others. You know, I've got so many monasteries and so many disciples. Who's the Bodhisattva? And she admitted, okay, you are. I jumped. Bodhisattva just means someone who's kind, who sacrifices themselves for others. But you know, sometimes you think about the idea of an enlightened being is selfish, by leaving the world. And that just make no sense to me, because the more you develop your meditation, the more the self disappears. I often say to people on retreats and even here, that you are disappearing, you're vanishing, your sense of self is totally disappearing. It's one of the reasons why that lovely cartoon we had at Jhana Grove, I Want Happiness. You remember that one? I think I mention it a lot because it's a great cartoon. I want happiness. Two mistakes. Number one mistake, I. So scrub that out. Want happiness. Second mistake, want. You take those two words out of it, what's left? There you go. That's the solution. I want means no happiness. Get rid of those two things. And that's all that's left, happiness. And that's a very deep teaching. Simple, but that's why I liked it, it was just right on the point. So as we develop our meditation, our relaxing to the max, how can you be relaxed when you want something? That's what causes you tension. I need a better job. I need better pay. I need a better partner. I need a better seat in the Buddhist Society of West Australia on a Friday night. I need to have personal air conditioning. I need to have better seats. What do you want? When you want, you can never find happiness. And the wanting comes from the eye. That's what the eye does. It always wants things. I always remember that when people used to say, all I want is like a nice home. Do you like a nice home? If I could give you a nice house to stay in, would you be happy? You'd be excited, but you won't be happy. you can always get a bigger home. What about a nice job? A nice job as a mattress tester. I don't know the jobs people get. But anyway, you're not happy. It's amazing how people get really rich. They win lottos. Would you like to win the lotto? Be honest. So many people who win the lotto end up ruining their lives. It's well known if you win the lotto this week, you buy another lottery ticket next week. Why? Isn't a few million dollars, $40 million enough? We can always use more. Remember this article, This article somebody sent to me, this lady in England, she won, the British lottery. I think something like 100 million or something British sterling pounds, tax-free, or in a lump sum. 100 million, what would you do? So what she did was buy this big mansion in Sussex. She sold it after 1 year and moved back into a little terraced house, a two up, two down. And she wrote the article about it. Why did you buy this huge mansion in a wonderful part of UK and sell it after only 1 year at a loss? And she said, because that was ruining my family. I never saw my husband. He was in another wing of the house. My daughter was in the upstairs portion of the house where she had about three or four rooms. My son was in his portion of the house. I could never find the people I loved and cared for. He said, now I've moved into a small house. I see my husband and my kids every day. It's wonderful. Little by little, how much do you really need? How much do you want? So the stillness, the contentment, those people I saw in those little houses in Thailand, just laughing. I remember these memories have stuck with me for years. This was maybe about 45 years ago. There was a ceremony in a poor village monastery, and I had a couple of hours spare. I went for a walk in the forest, and I came across this very poor house. And I came across it because there was screaming in the house. The kids were having the wail of a time, as they probably did every day, just playing around with each other, cracking jokes, and mum and dad also just, they were some of the happiest people I've ever seen. And I thought after that this is something I never saw in London. This is like the simplicity, the time for one another, and the caring for one another. And I thought that was a wealthy society. So please don't spoil your happiness by getting wealthy. It's really bad for your mental health. So if any of you do win the lottery on the weekend or whenever, please come and see me and I can relieve you of a lot of stress. Okay, that's only a joke. No, just the idea that stillness and meditation, learning how to relax. If you do have lots of money, can you really relax? Or are you worried about having to invest it? Worrying about loaning it to people and they won't pay it back? Does it make you more worried? Whatever makes you more worried, of course, that is bad for your health. So learning how to relax to the max, as best you possibly can. So when people take photographs, I can't help posing. Why not? Anyway, so that's just how we can live a very peaceful, happy life. And that's what meditation is. Learning how to let go and be still and to enjoy. The happiness which comes from meditation is immense. And you can see beauty in things which you thought could never see. It brings happiness. Simple joys of life. Okay, I've talked over much again. You should tax me tonight. So any questions from the audience first of all? Oh, do they after the finishing of the talk? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Okay, there's a question over there. Yeah, what have you got? Yeah.
Recently, I had a surgery, and just in the middle of the night, I would just wake up aching, and it's really hard to just get back into the, you know, stillness and try to relax and sleep. So would you have some kind of practical tips or advice to, you know, help work towards that?
Certainly. Just instead of actually tensing up around the pain or around the injury, see if you can go into it. Go the opposite direction, which you normally do. Because if we have pain or an ache or an injury, we often like to go somewhere where that pain isn't. Try and escape from it. Take some Panadol or something or other so you don't feel the pain anymore. Instead of doing that, just go the opposite direction, go right into it with a lot of kindness and softness. And that softness heals a lot of the pain. I learned this as a kid, that sometimes, you know, small injuries, like I would play soccer in the streets, you know, because we lived in a small government-funded housing, not actually just apartments, and that's the best place you could play soccer with your friends, you know, on the street. And every time you went for a tackle, you know, you scraped the skin off your knees. I always had scabs on my knees when I was growing up. And if it really hurt yourself, you start crying. I was only a small kid. And my mother would come up towards me, and she would just kneel down and kiss the wound. And all those germs in a sort of an open mouth on that open wound, it never got infected. Instead, the pain would go away immediately. She'd always call it kissing it better. I never understood medicine at that time, but it always worked. And I learned just that little bit of kindness was always necessary to take away the ache and the pain. So I don't know where your mother is, but if she lives with you, get her to come in and kiss it better. It actually works. Just that kindness. Do it for yourself. Just, you know, feel that and just be as compassionate as you possibly can to it. You'll be amazed sometimes how it'll be really aching, and then after a minute or two, it's just gone. The body just stops aching. Anyway, got a few questions here, so I should be here. From Malaysia. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm always worried about my end-of-year medical examination. I always tell myself that I'm not good enough and feel that I did not do my best. Could you help? That's exactly the same question which everybody else doing that test says. They don't think they're good enough. Sometimes you need to hypnotize you and say, look at me. Repeat after me. I am good enough. Am I good enough to be a monk? Am I good enough to be a teacher? I don't know, but I am, so I just do it. When you really relax to the max, whatever you're doing, you do actually fine. Okay, remember to be kind to your knee. Very good. That's a gentleman in the back there. Sometimes you surprise yourself. But if you're doing an examination and you feel you did not do my best, of course you did your very best. It's the best you could do with all the problems you had. But when you're doing examination, this is how I used to pass my exams. This was at Cambridge in quantum physics and goodness knows what else. I would meditate before the exam. You know, sometimes I didn't have any lunch. I just went back to my room and sat down. And what happened was, I'm being absolutely honest here, the first thing which came into my mind was the morning exam. How well did I do? Did I do the questions correctly or not? And what a waste of time that was. The exam was finished. It was in, I couldn't change it. Why was I wasting my energy onto something which you couldn't do anything about? So I stopped thinking about the morning exam. It was gone. The next thing which came into my mind was the afternoon exam. Should I do some more studies? And I tell many children this, in my experience, every time I studied something an hour before the exam. It never, ever came up. It was, again, a total waste of time. And the reason a few of you are chuckling, because it happened to you as well. So I stopped thinking about the afternoon exam. And that was really fascinating, because then I came into this moment and I noticed I was actually shaking, physically shaking. Because this was like big exams. And I'd really put everything into the morning exam. I was tired. I never noticed those nerves. But then when I could notice my body, it was pretty easy to settle those nerves, to relax the max, my body through awareness. And then the last thing I noticed was how tired my brain was. Just done a 3-hour exam on quantum mechanics or astrophysics of the galaxy. That's tough stuff. Of course your brain was tired, it's natural. But as soon as I noticed my tired brain and just left it alone, energy came up again. And the afternoon examinations, this was the final exams at Cambridge. And my friends told me this, and they never told me at the time. They said I was smiling, the only student smiling in the afternoon exams. And they thought I was cheating. I said, no, I'm not cheating. Well, maybe, meditating. But of course, I also taught that, you can check it out, at Carmel School, the Jewish school here in Perth, a few years ago. The chaplain there at the time, Rabbi Moshe Bernstein, who's a good mate of mine, he invited me there for the day. And I taught the kids exactly what I just said. And a few weeks later, I got a nice letter back from the principal. That year, they got the best school in West Australia, year 12 exams. So he said, thank you. I was really quite happy with that. Anyway, so don't need to be worried at all. From Popin in Australia. Very much, I have a mature meditation practice. However, during times of life stresses, the traumatic experience of the hand of my father surface. He continues to be partially in my life. Can you please offer some advice? Please, if he's caused you trauma, and he's not causing you trauma anymore, you're safe now, then make sure that you forgive him. Really full on forgiveness. You say, well, I can't do that. Why not? I was telling somebody a few days ago that story of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And I always get a bit teary when I say this, so please forgive me. Because it's a beautiful story. A South African police officer was confessing how he tortured and killed a black African ANC activist. ANC, that's Nelson Mandela's group. And that the rules were, if you were honest and told the truth, then you had amnesty. You could walk free. And this policeman was just shaking, was this emotional turmoil for him, actually admitting what he'd done to another human being. And the black African's wife was in that court listening. The first time she had heard what happened to this man she loved and married, the father of her children, who just disappeared in the middle of the night. She didn't know what happened. She had no way of finding out what happened, except to this Reconciliation Commission. And of course, this soldier was just shaking in fear and guilt. And when his testimony was over, his wife leapt over the barrier separating the accused from the other people in the court. She's a very fit and fast. And avoided the 2 or 3 security guards and went straight for the man and gave him this huge hug and said, I forgive you. But she could do that. Why can't we forgive someone who's hurt us? That police officer tortured and killed her husband, just for no reason or another other than politics. And she could forgive that, and she did. And so can't you forgive your father? Don't know why he did that. Make sure you're safe now. Just, if you can forgive, a lot of that pain is gone. And the trauma is really weakened. It's basically, as one person said, who was one of the twins of a girl who was in Auschwitz. Because she was a twin, her twin sister was experimented on. And so she died, but this twin survived. She found out one of the doctors who had performed these experiments on her sister. And amazingly, she told the doctor to meet her in Auschwitz. And the doctor obliged. I think he was so scared. But anyway, when they met in Auschwitz, this girl forgave him. Said, all those things you did to me and to my sister, you're forgiven. And I can't imagine the sort of pain and the trauma of being in that situation. But she forgave, and she said, now I'm a victor, not a victim. That's how to be free. They've tortured you enough. They traumatize you enough. When you forgive, that's a great way of freedom. From Karata next. How can we break away from the craving of technology, social media? Why are you laughing? Are you caught up in that too? Sometimes when you find something better, and of course you're not so interested in all that stuff. This is one of the reasons why just a bit of meditation, a bit of kindness. It's much better to talk to people than to WhatsApp people. If you think it's much better to just contact each other on social media, then why don't you all stay at home? And this is all broadcast live on the internet. Why do you actually come here? Isn't there something different to hearing and seeing a live talk than actually seeing it recorded? Of course there is. That's why you come all this way. You park, you walk through the rain to get in here, and you sacrifice so much more by having it live. I don't know, even young people, you know, what musicians do they like? Would you rather see Taylor Swift? Is she still popular? Okay, I don't know. But you'd rather see Taylor Swift live or see her on a screen? If Taylor Swift was invited here during the rains, would you come? Would you think, no, it's too cold, no, the parking, I'm a bit busy this evening? You'd stop everything. Because it's important to you. The live performances are much more feeling, not just vision. You get much more input from that. It's one of the reasons why those are the arguments. You know, this is sometimes I think would be wonderful if, like, Zoom or the internet was a little bit more powerful, then I would never need to leave Bodhinyana Monastery. When you die, I didn't need to go to the funeral, do it all on YouTube. When you get married, you don't need to actually invite your partner who may be living overseas. You can get married on the internet. Would that work? No, of course it doesn't work. It's not close enough. It's not human enough. It's not real enough. So after a while, I use some of those arguments. And for young people, and of course it doesn't work, but it gives them a start to how it can work. You realize that life is much more fascinating and beautiful when it's not on a screen like this, but you're actually looking at somebody. Anyway, lastly, from Michigan in the United States. Dear Ajahn, I'm a newbie to Buddhism. Can you please explain what does sadhu mean and why do you say it three times? Thank you. Sadhu means awesome. And everything we do is in three times in Buddhism. We have the triple gem, we have the, what else do we have? We always walk around things three times. We always, when we give a donation, we always give it three times. No, so sadhu, but the reason we do it three times, it means sadhu means awesome. I mean, it's really good, it's cool, it's wonderful. So it's terms of well done. We do it three times because the first time we say it, it's never really full enough. So remember, we can do it again now. Sadhu. And the second time, really louder. Sadhu. And the third time, sadhu. It actually feels better. You're smiling now. Because it's the end of the talk. That's why you're smiling. No, it's more than that. So sadhu means awesome. And I give it a bit more energy than most monks at the end because that's a beautiful way of ending a talk. You know, joy. At the end of a good concert, if ever you see Taylor Swift, at the end of her concert, just put your hands up and go, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's a much better way of ending. Okay. So now we can pay respects to the Buddha three times. And then any other questions, come up and ask them.